You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. And I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helpful information who are working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound and make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, I'm very happy to have a returning guest in Peter Bregman. Peter is the CEO of Bregman Partners, a global management consulting company where he is the advisor to CEOs as well as their top management teams on leadership and workplace issues. He has appeared on CNN and PBS. He writes for HBR.org, Psychology Today, Fast Company, and Forbes.com. Peter is a regular contributor to WNYC Radio, which is New York's NPR affiliate, and has spoken at TEDx. And TEDx's mission is ideas worth spreading. So I bring you a man who truly has ideas worth spreading. Peter, welcome to Answers for the Family.
It's so fun to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I was so glad to be able to have you on again because I really enjoyed the last time, and I really got some great feedback. After the show, I got some text messages, I got some emails, and from people that really talked about how, you know, the gaining information that really helped them at work translated so well over to their family and how they managed their family better, but also how they enjoyed their family better. So I really am glad to have you back on again.
That's really nice to hear. I was thinking, actually, as I was listening to the bio, that I should definitely have in there that I'm the father of three kids and devoted husband the challenges and blessings that I face in my life at home are not that different than they are at work. So I see a lot of connections between those.
Well, it sure does, and I'm glad that our listeners saw that, you know, that they really picked up on that you know, that the same things that we were talking about the last time, they really felt that it fit right in for them. So, but I'm glad that you added that. Now we started this, or the press release that we sent out was really talking about some of the questions that we can ask ourselves that can help us. So let's just start with, I mean, what can we do, I mean, right now that would be the most powerful use of a particular moment to be able to help us, you know, as a person, as a parent, or as somebody working in a business?
You know, it's a great, I mean, I love that question. First of all, I love questions. I think questions are so much more interesting than answers usually. And, you know, our instinct with a question is to have it resolve itself as quickly as possible into an answer so we can move on. But I actually think wallowing in the questions and swimming in the questions and enjoying the questions themselves is really, really useful. And that question, you know, how can I make the most powerful use of this moment? It's not always an immediate answer, but if you keep asking that question moment to moment, your life begins to change because you begin to make different choices. You know, think of a very, very basic conversation. You're in a conversation with someone, and you can pause for a second and then say, you know, how can I make the most powerful moment, use of this moment? And you realize there's something that you have left unsaid, that you're talking around an issue, but you're not really facing the issue. And that actually by facing the issue, you're going to make an incredible, though it may be scary, you make this incredibly powerful use of the moment. You know, another is your, I mean, this happened to me recently. We're talking about family. It's the same elements as you have with leadership. My son and I were having this pillow fight, and I warned him, don't throw the pillow right here because there's this vase. Don't do it. And he did it anyway, and it knocked the vase down, and nothing broke, but the water came. And I saw this look of his face, which was sort of terrified. And my instinct was to yell at him, right, to say, look, I told you. But I looked at his face, and I thought, to myself, what's the most powerful use of this moment? Like, I don't need him scared. I need him learning. And how often do we react in a way, whether at work or personally, you know, to out of our own emotion that ends up scaring someone but misses the point of what it is we're trying to achieve? I talk about this at work a lot, this idea that holding someone accountable versus drawing out their performance are two very different things. And that we think if we hold someone accountable for something, we're going to draw out the higher performance. But the reality is, those two are often in direct opposition. And you hold someone accountable for something, and you end up hurting their performance. And that there's a way of drawing out their performance so that they do better without necessarily feeling like they failed or feeling like they've had trouble. It's the same thing with kids. It's the same thing with work.
Okay, well, so in the situation of the pillow fight, which first of all I think is great because I love pillow fights, but how did you turn that into a lesson versus a "see, I told you so"?
You know, I stopped and I said, Daniel, I already know. He said, but I said, I already know you shouldn't have done that. Right? I see it in your face. I see it in your face. How could you, you know, it became this conversation, and I'm probably at fault a little bit for speaking too much to my kids as opposed to action. I like having this conversation like this, and they seem to rise to the occasion. But I sort of said, okay, look, I know you shouldn't have done that, but so how do you resist that in the future? There's other times when you know, like, how could you have stopped yourself before doing it, right? I mean, I thought that was kind of an interesting question. I don't know that it had an impact, really. I mean, he's fixed. But he did have an answer to it. You know, his answer was, you should have looked at me more seriously. Like, I was kind of laughing with him, going, don't do it. You know, and I'm kind of laughing. And his says, you know, he's kind of saying, if you looked at me more seriously, I kind of thought you were joking the whole time. That was actually really useful feedback for me. So, like, and now he doesn't feel stepped on, but we have a different way of communicating around this stuff. I found that that was more useful than if I just scared him and he ran into his room and started crying on his bed.
Well, yeah, and that's actually pretty deep for a six-year-old. You know, I like that. And I couldn't agree more, and I may be guilty of some of the same things you're talking about when you say as far as talking too much to the kids, because now mine are pretty much grown, and there will be something that will occur or whatever, and they'll look at one of their friends and they'll go, well, Dad's going to figure out a way to turn this into a learning experience, you know?
There's a worse rap you could get. So,
absolutely.
Like, that's not so terrible.
Absolutely. So, now, you know, we talked a little bit about what, you know, as far as what we can do or how we can, bring up questions in regards to this moment. Yesterday, we had a huge celebration. The love of my life just turned a milestone age, so we had a lot of people here, and it was great. It was beautiful. There was a ton of love and everything else. But one of the things that I found was I couldn't spend enough time with everybody, you know, and I found myself at times, you know, sort of, you know, I would love to be in this conversation longer, but you know, I'm the host here, but I'm thinking all of this. I'm not verbalizing it. So, I mean, what are some of the ways that we can, you know, for somebody else, you know, to where, you know, what can we say to somebody else that can kind of bring both sides of the conversation to a conclusion where we don't feel like we're sort of cutting them off? And that was a concern that I just had yesterday.
Tell me a little more about it.
Well, just from the standpoint of, you know, what can we say to others, you know, where we want to bring both sides of a conversation to a good conclusion at that point? In other words, we want it to come to a conclusion where you're in a conversation with somebody and it sort of feels like you're kind of in a loop. And you don't want to be rude,
right,
and just go, okay, you know what, I got to go, you know, or, you know, I
right.
really need to do something else. You're kind of stuck in this loop, and
I want to
bring it to a positive conclusion where it's good for both sides, and I found
yep.
myself struggling with that.
Got it. Totally understand. So, you know, a really good thing to do, usually when we're in a loop in a conversation, what it means is that neither party feels heard. So why is it that you repeat what you're saying over and over again? If you're saying something and you find yourself repeating yourself over and over again, now why is that? It's because you feel like they haven't heard it. Because if you actually felt like they heard you, then you wouldn't feel the need to repeat it. So if you know, under that assumption, right, that in a looped conversation where we're repeating ourselves over and over again, where neither of us are feeling heard, your best move is to do what you need to do so that the other person feels heard. So that usually means a combination of actually listening to them. It means empathizing. It means often paraphrasing or repeating back, this is what you've heard, to be able to say, hold on, I know we've repeated ourselves a bunch. I want to make sure I'm really understanding what you're saying. Is what you're saying blah, 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 blah? And if it's not quite right, I'll say, no, that's not it. Now, here's the mistake you should not make. Don't tell them to say again what they were trying to say, because that's going to just create the loop again. So what you want to do is be able to say, so let me make sure I understand. Is this what you're saying? And they go, no, that's not it. And then you can say, what part did I get wrong? Like, what did I miss?
Got it.
So get them to just focus on the piece that they feel like you misunderstood. And then when they say it, do that again. Repeat it back. To say, oh, so now I'm understanding it, blah, blah, blah. Have I gotten that right? And then they'll say, yeah. And you'll notice at that point their shoulders will relax. If you're not on the phone, you'll notice that. Maybe if you're on Skype, you'll notice it. But their shoulders will relax. They take a deep breath. And they will no longer feel the need to repeat themselves. And at that point, you then have the opening to be able to say, can I share with you what I'm trying to get across, right? Or what I'm trying to say, or how I'm feeling. And then they will feel more space because they feel heard. They'll feel more space to then let you say what you need to say and for them to really hear it. It changes the flow of the conversation often.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And we have a listener question that has come in via email. And again, I want to tell everybody, thank you so much for sending these in. I appreciate you taking the time. I know that we get some from people who receive the press release and they know that they are going to be at work and they can't listen right now. So they send us this. We get the question out, and then they listen at a later time. They listen on iTunes, or they go to our website and listen. So again, thank you so much for that. So this question reads, I've been receiving your newsletter since I heard you on Alan's show last year, and your work is so, in quotes, right on. My question, we have an associate at our office who spends 90% of every conversation discussing her problems and projecting negative what-ifs. She tunes us out whenever we talk about letting go of expectations and living in the moment. Excuse me. I would love some direction on recommendations on how to deal with her without being rude, as I am almost at the end of my rope of patience.
So it's a great question, and thank you for actually emailing and being back on the listening to the radio this time. It's a great question, and usually we handle those situations, myself included, because it's very seductive. We handle those situations in precisely the wrong way, in precisely the way that reignites and maintains the whining or the complaining. So what we do, and you alluded to it in the question, when someone's complaining about stuff is you try to make them feel better. You tell them to look at the bright side, or you try to look at the bright side, or you show them how they could do something to get themselves out of the situation, or you do something to try to make the situation better. Part of the reason that we do that is because we are often uncomfortable with other people's discomfort. We don't like it. Mm-hmm. We're uncomfortable with it. We don't want to be in the presence of it. It makes us uncomfortable. And so we try to erase it. We try to make them feel better. Also, we like to make people feel better. That's a nice thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem with that reaction. The problem is that when you're trying to make someone feel better, you're basically arguing with them. They're coming and complaining about something that they feel stuck about, and they're not actually asking for your ideas or your opinions or to fix it. They just want you, again, to understand or to feel for them what they're feeling and to have a sense of it. And you're, in effect, arguing with them that they shouldn't feel that way, or they don't have to feel that way, or in effect, they're feeling that way at their own fault because they're not doing anything to get themselves out of it. And you're not necessarily using that language. But when you're trying to solve their problem, again, they're not really feeling hurt. And if you actually want to both make them feel better and shut down the conversation, the best way you can do it is to reflect back what you said, what you've heard. It's the same advice in many ways that I just gave you around the looped conversation. This is, in effect, another looped conversation, right? Someone's complaining and whining and they won't stop. So what you could say instead is, wow, I could really see how hard this is on you. I could really see how difficult it is for you to deal with the situation, or how challenging a situation it is for you. I can really see it and I can really feel it. What are they going to do next? They're going to keep complaining and keep complaining? Probably that'll put an end to it. And if you want to put an end to it, you can say, I could really see that and I'm really sorry it's so hard for you. And then stop.
Yeah,
and once you take the next step to give them advice, now you've continued the conversation. Now they have something new to talk about, right, which is your advice. But you don't really want them to have something new to talk about. You want to stop the conversation. So just hearing them is a really nice way of stopping the conversation and making them feel good, because you've validated at least that they've been heard. Let me add one other thing, Alan, which is that listening to someone is not the same as agreeing with them. So even if you disagree with someone, you could feel okay listening to them. Meaning, it's not, a lot of times we don't listen because we think it would signify agreement. So they're complaining about something and you think they're a complainer. It's okay. You could think they're a complainer. You don't have to tell them you could think they're a complainer. You could just tell them that you understand that it's very hard for them. That doesn't mean that you agree with them that they're in a stuck, impossible situation they can't get out of. It just means that you've heard that it's really hard for them. And that often makes them feel better and shuts down the conversation so that you don't have to sit in it for another 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. And I think for a lot of us and a lot of the people listening, are in what we would call the helping fields. So I know there's lots of educational consultants, psychiatrists, psychologists. We're kind of in this helping field thing to where we sometimes just can't help ourselves. I mean, they're going into this and we kind of try to, we fall into this kind of work mode of, I can fix this. And you're right. It's as if we're sort of arguing with them or not.
You know, it's such an interesting thing, Alan, because I recently came across this myself about my own behavior, that I was talking to some people and they said, "I'm worried that you're trying to fix me," right? And I'm honestly, I'm thinking to myself, like, isn't that what you want?
You know, like, yeah.
Like, you're coming to me for advice. Like, you want me to fix you? Like, you're right. Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
I want to fix you because, you know, that's why you come to me. But what I really, like, came to realize as I talked to them more is, and I really understood it, they don't want me to fix them. Like, they want me to really listen to them. And this is so hard. I think it's harder for men to figure out than women. I mean, I was in this conversation with my wife recently where she was talking to me about some stuff and I felt really bad. And she was, complaining might be a hard word, but she was, you know, she was struggling with something. And, of course, it's very easy to solve other people's problems, right? I mean, it's, you know, a lot easier than it is to solve our own. But so I'm listening to her, and I'm really, like, just listening. Like, I'm really listening. And it's a little hard for me at a certain point not to throw in, you know, like, a thought or here's what might solve this, et cetera. And when we talked about the conversation later that night, this was an early morning conversation, when we talked about the conversation later that night, she talked to me about how incredibly useful it was that I just listened and that I didn't give her advice and that when I did give her some advice, it made it harder for her, but that when I wasn't giving her advice, it actually, and when I was just listening without judgment, it actually made her take a different kind of ownership for her own problem. Meaning it wasn't about me. I didn't have an interest. I mean, this is my wife, like, we're, you know, like, yeah. Her struggles are my struggles. And, but I wasn't, by not giving her advice or by not pushing her in direction, just by listening, she felt suddenly like, I wasn't going to fix it, and she wasn't going to push against me because there was nothing to push against. And that generated in her a new kind of ownership to say, I need to step up here and make a decision and solve my own issue because nobody's going to solve this for me. And that means that if I'm in my situation, I'm in it because I'm choosing to be in it. If I'm out of it, I'm choosing to be out of it in the particular way that I choose to be out of it. And it was this sort of profound experience of self-responsibility that she had that I easily would have destroyed by telling her what to do. So I really sort of understood in a new way this idea that, you know, people actually aren't hiring me to fix them. Mm-hmm. They're hiring me to listen. They're hiring me to get some perspective when they ask. And they're hiring me to you know, add some value to a conversation that they need to then figure out. And it's what we need to do as leaders in organizations. It's what we need to do as you know, heads of families, as partners. It's we need to be the kind of person that people want to talk to and that helps the people around us, who helps the people around us take responsibility and take accountability for their own issues and make the moves that are going to move them forward in the way that they want to move forward.
That is beautifully put. I couldn't agree more. We are going to take a break. For those of you that want to follow along with us, you can open up, if you're at a computer, you can open up another window. You can go to peterbrigman.com. That's PETERBREGMAN.com. You can open up another window and you can kind of follow along with some of the things that we're talking about. We're going to take a break, but we will be right back in 1 minute. Stay with us here on Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We are speaking with Peter Bregman, and we are talking about the questions that you can ask yourself, the questions that you can ask other people, but the things that you can talk about that will help you become a better leader. It will help you in your relationships with your children, with your family, with your employees. It will help you all the way around. And Peter, we were talking a little bit about some of the questions, but what about the old adage that it's not what you say, but it's how you say it? How does that apply also to sort of our everyday conversations?
I think that's true in many ways. I mean, I just remember reading recently somebody who was discussing a speech he was in that he worked for Next, Apple, you know, the sort of where Steve Jobs was before he had returned to Apple. And he said, and Steve Jobs was very upset about something, and he said, like most people who I spoke to about Steve Jobs, we don't actually remember what he said. We just remember, like, his demeanor, the aggression, or the dissatisfaction, you know, the feeling they got from him, which was a real discomfort. And I think it's actually very true. I mean, really, we rarely remember what someone has said. Which is a shame for someone like me who does a lot of speaking. But you rarely remember what people say. But you do remember the feel you get from them. You do remember the sense of, you know, did you feel cared for? Did you feel aggression? Did you feel love? Did you feel disgust? You know, like, so, I mean, those are huge distinctions. But those are the things that generally we remember. And I think how you say things is incredibly important. Now, sometimes you have to be careful because there's a disconnect, meaning you'll try to say something in this sort of sickly sweet voice that's underneath it really mean, and there's discordance between what you're saying and how you're saying it. Uh-huh. And that's hard for people. Then people begin to feel uneasy for the wrong reasons, you know, not because of what you're saying, but just because it feels some hypocrisy, in terms of how you're being, or inauthenticity, right? So you want to be careful that you don't come off as inauthentic because you're trying to say something in a nice way. It's actually really biting. And I think that there's a lot of power to people who are able to articulate in a really, really clear way what they're feeling without a lot of hemming and hawing and a lot of beating around the bush. On the other hand, people who say things without much compassion often are not so fun to be around either. So, you know, there's this balance, but I think if you come, and here's what I often do for myself, is I will pause before I say something that I think might be harsh, right, or anything that's, you know, anything that's not in the category of purely complimentary. I will pause and I will ask myself, in whose interest am I saying this? Like, am I saying this for me? Am I saying this so I feel better than this person? Am I saying this because it'll make me feel better to have the answer? Am I saying this because I'll come out looking a certain way? Like, are those the reasons? And if the answer is those are the reasons I'm saying it, then I really do my best to shut myself up. And it happens a lot. I mean, I think it's very natural that we say things that aren't always in the best interest of the other person, but we're doing it in order to make ourselves feel better. Yeah, and I don't, you know, I'm not above that. I do that too. And so by asking myself that question, it helps me to be clean about what I'm about to do and what I'm about to say. And I'm able to pause and say, yeah, you know what? I am saying it in their best interest, but the way I was about to do it was in a way that would just make myself feel better. And so I need to do it differently. It's not about me. It's about helping them. And I need to say this in a way that really is about them and doesn't make me feel better because I'm justified because it wasn't my mistake. It was their mistake, right? Well, yeah, that's fine. So I don't want to be culpable for some mistake. But that doesn't mean that I come out with blame when I'm trying to address a real valid issue of a problem that happened. So that's, you know, that's an example of saying, I could address a problem issue in someone. Let's even say it's an employee or a child, right? I could address a problem issue, and I could do it in the way that leaves me not at all culpable and puts all the blame on them, and I'm still really dealing with the issue, and they are at blame. Uh-huh. Or I could do it in a way that recognizes that I play a role in it too, and I can be softer about how I approach it in a way that I think has much greater impact and also leaves them feeling good and more willing to make that change. That's, again, that difference between holding someone accountable and actually drawing out their performance.
Right. And then, and as you said, you know, how are they going to be left in regards to how they feel about that? Are they going to move forward based on the fact that they went away feeling like, you know, that they felt good, they felt like this is something worth listening to, versus, you know, now I feel crappy about myself. You know,
right.
So I think that's
right.
A great point. And the other thought that I had, you brought up earlier in regards to authenticity. I think authenticity is so important, and it actually made me think of something recently that, in regards to dealing with, besides everything else that I do, I also write scripts. And you know, I was. Are you outside at the moment? Because it seems like the sound just changed on your end. Is everything okay?
Oh yeah, everything's fine. How is it now?
Okay. No, now it's good. But just for a moment there, it's as if you kind of went outside or something, and we got a little bit of a wind thing.
Okay,
we're all good. But anyway, when to me, there's that other side of it where authenticity comes in, and it's so important. And I was describing another person and saying one of the things that I love about them is, how authentic, how honest they are, and I will send a script over to them because I know that they will tell me the absolute truth, even if it's not what I want to hear. You know, and that to me is so important because I think we all have friends, like you said, you know, they don't want to hurt your feelings, you know, so you send something over to them and they read it and they go, oh, that's cute. That's sweet. That's nice. You know, but is it good? You know, is it something that, you know, that captured you? Is it something that you couldn't put down? You know, those are the things we're looking for, and so I'm glad that you brought up authenticity because, you know, just saying the nice things isn't always what people need or really even what they want.
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, it actually reminds me of a conversation that I had with my daughter where I said something to her. I can't remember what it was. I think you're beautiful, or that was great, or I can't remember what it was. And her response was, of course you think that. You're my dad. You have to think that. Right? And I said, look, I'm your dad, but I don't have to think that. And maybe I'm slightly more predisposed to think it because I love you. Mm-hmm. But also because I love you, I'm going to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's my commitment. My commitment is to tell you the truth. So maybe I'm going to like more things that you do because I love you. But I will also tell you the truth. And I think that's really, you know, that shouldn't be just the way we act with our children. It really should be the way we act with everybody, in a sense, which is that I love you and I'm going to tell you the truth. There was another thought that I had, which was in the question that you asked, which is when you were talking about the script and you said, is it the questions you asked, if I'm remembering correctly now, is it good? Did it move you? I can't remember the other question you asked, but did you have a hard time putting it down? And I want to make a distinction between those questions because it falls into a trap that we fall into sometimes that doesn't serve us. And that is that the question of I love the question, did you have a hard time putting it down? I love the question, did it move you? Right? If I'm going to give you something of mine to look at, I want to know how it impacted you. And if you ask me something about it, I want to tell you what my experience is of it. But I don't necessarily want to hear from you the judgment of was it good or was it not good. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard, that's the kind of judgment that I think ends up, we ask it all the time. I ask it all the time in my writing. You know, I'll go and I'll ask this, you know, like, what do you think? Was it good? Mm-hmm. And I realize as soon as I ask that, like, what am I looking for? Like, I'm looking for them to tell me it was good, you know?
Right.
And they feel that pressure. And so that's where I may not get the straight answer. But if I say, you know, how did you feel when you were reading it? Well, you know, I'm more likely to get an honest answer in that kind of a question than just like, you know, how was it? You know, if I ask someone about the talk, a talk that I just gave, and if I said, how was it? They're going to say it was good. It was really good. If I say, you know, what were the top three things you got out of that talk? Now I'm going to actually really learn something that's valuable, especially if everybody comes up with three different things. Now I'm going to think, oh, maybe I wasn't so clear. Maybe. So I think the way we communicate and what we ask for from people, you know, once we step away from the approval or the disapproval or their judgment or their lack of judgment, that's where we begin to really gain value and have a real authentic relationship with the other person.
Well, and yes, I completely agree. And so, I mean, we've been talking a lot in this case about some of the questions that we're going to ask other people. What are some of the questions that we can ask ourselves to bring our own focus to what is really important to our life?
You know, we opened up with this question, like, what is the most powerful use of this moment? And I love that question. I love it. Like, because it really says, here's what that question says. I don't have power over time, right? In effect. Like, I can't make this moment actually last 10 years, and I can't make this moment over in a second. The moment exists. It exists independent of me. The question that I can ask is, given that this is the moment that I have, what am I going to do with it? And what I choose to do with it makes all of the difference in the world. And it actually gives you all of the power of the moment. So I love that question because it admits on the one hand that I'm powerless and on the other hand that I have complete and total power. And so that, to me, that's a really great question. The other question, you know, that I think that helps to inform this question of, you know, what is the most powerful use of this moment is, what is it that I'm going for? Like, what do I want? Mm-hmm. Right? What do I want in my life? Right? That's a basic question. We get caught up trying to answer that question a lot. You know, we really often get caught up not really knowing the answer or spending 5 years trying to figure out the answer or making the answer perfect so you never really follow through on anything because nothing's ever perfect. And I think that's one of those questions that's good to ask and answer lightly. Like if this were a workshop mm-hmm. and we were talking about these questions, I would say, you have a minute and a half. No, that's too long. You have a minute to write about what is it that you really want in this life. Go. Right? And at the end of the minute, I bet whatever you write will be as strong, if not stronger, than if you took 3 years to figure out exactly the right answer. So take that thing that you came up with in a minute and start to assess, like, am I living my life in a way that's bringing that to me? Like, am I living my life in a way that is making, you know, use of the moment that's bringing me closer to, you know, what's important to me in my life? You know, when you look at my book, 18 Minutes, it's focused on really understanding at the beginning of the year, what is it that I want to accomplish this mm-hmm. year? And not even really what do I want to accomplish. What do I want to spend my time on this year? What would feel valuable and fulfilling to spend my time on? And then I suggest you write to-do lists based on those things. Come up with five things that seem like where you want to spend your time. And then create your to-do list in those five boxes so that you know that day to day, the things you're going to do will keep you focused in the areas that you most want to focus on for the year. And then suddenly you'll look back at the end of the year and you'll say, I used my time well.
Now, what would you say? You touched on something just a little bit ago. And what would you say to the person that you believe has sort of a fear of failure? You mentioned about the people that really, you know, they don't get started because they're afraid they're going to fail anyway, which I think, and I've seen it in many people, to where, you know, I think that they have so much going for them and they have so many great ideas and they're just incredibly wonderful people, and then they don't seem to take whatever that next step is that allows them to share this greatness with so many other people. And so what would you tell somebody that deep down they kind of know that they're doing that themselves?
You know that song in Frozen that's become so famous, Let It Go? Let it go, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Let it go. No, actually, it's that's what most people would say. It's just let it go. Don't worry about it, right? But that doesn't work. Because you can't let go of fear. I mean, it's to someone who's not afraid, it's very easy to say let it go. I mean, it's very easy for someone who's not afraid to say let it go. But to someone who is afraid, you can't just let it go because you actually feel afraid. You know, like you can't.
Right.
I mean, it's not that easy in my view. I mean, it would be nice if it were, and certain spiritual practices suggest that it should be, but that's not been my experience. Here's, you know, we're talking about questions a lot today, so let me throw in a question. What's the worst that would happen if I failed?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just ask yourself that question. What's going to happen? You know, I started a set of leadership programs really close to my heart. Things that are really, you know, I really feel like I have a sense of how I want to teach leadership in a way that's being taught very, very differently than anybody else teaches it. I'm clear on it. I've run it a couple of times. It's really been profound, and I really want it out there in the world. And I'm terrified. I'm terrified that I'm going to, you know, create programs and nobody's going to come. I'm not terrified that it's not good or that it doesn't really work, because I have a real experience about that, but I am terrified that people won't like it, and I'm terrified that, you know, they won't give it a chance, or I'm terrified that what I'm most afraid of is I won't fill the room, right? You know, I'll have people come in and invite them and rent out the space and do everything I need to do to prep, and then, you know, there'll be one person there. And I was holding myself back from doing it as a result of that. I mean, I wasn't setting dates. I wasn't designing the program. I wasn't renting space. Because what if I failed? And I just asked that question. You know, what's the worst thing that would happen? Like, really, what would happen? And I could spin out of control. I mean, I could say, well, what would happen is nobody would come up, and then I'd be holding it, and then it would be humiliating, and I would be exposed as a fraud, and then I would lose my business, and then my wife would leave me, and then my kids would hate me, and I would lose my house. And, like, you know, we could do that. Or we could realistically go, what would happen if I failed? What would happen? What would happen if nobody showed up? Well, what would happen if nobody showed up is I would be out the deposit for the rental. That's what would happen. And that's about it. What would happen if I filled the room and I bombed? Like, what would happen if I filled the room and everybody left halfway through saying, this is complete rubbish? Well, I guess I would feel that, right? I mean, ultimately, when you're afraid of something, what you're afraid of is afraid of a feeling.
Right.
Basically, we're afraid of feeling something. Even the worst thing, if you're afraid of losing all of your money and your home, you're not afraid of being homeless. You're afraid of what it will feel like to be homeless. We fear feeling. We don't fear experience. We fear feeling. We fear what an experience will feel like. So when you realize that, and this is part of what I teach in leadership, is you realize we have to become really comfortable with feeling a diversity of things. Because if we could become comfortable feeling a wide variety of things, well, then our fears will diminish substantially because, again, because we're afraid of what we might feel. Well, let's have a practice then of feeling everything deeply. And then there's nothing that you end up fearing, because feeling your feelings deeply is the thing that most of us fear most.
All right. Well, unfortunately, as I look at it, we're about to run out of time, and I don't want to do that without having a chance to ask you. You just mentioned about these leadership courses. Do you have any of them that are coming up? And if so, when and where, so that we can all help you fill those rooms so that you can get the right feeling?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm actually, for the first time, doing something out on the West Coast. On May 13th of this year, in L.A., we're running a one-day leadership program. It's an intro to Bregman leadership, and it should be a lot of fun, and we're going to really, it's really experiential. So my programs are not about sitting in the back of a room with a notepad taking notes. It's really about doing work, engaging in work together, and so we're going to do a lot of that in the intro to Bregman leadership, and people will get a feel for, you know, one of the things that we teach is emotional courage. Emotional courage, to me, is the big tool. It's the main characteristic that bridges the gap between what we know and what we do. That bridges the gap between knowing I could do something and actually doing it, or knowing I should do something and then actually doing it. So we work a lot with emotional courage, and that to me is the critical skill of leadership that I don't ever see taught in leadership programs. So the next one we're running is a one-day intro in L.A. I'm also running it in New York on June 26th in New York City, a one-day. And then we have, I'm going to be doing some stuff at Kripalu. It's a yoga, meditation, leadership retreat center in Massachusetts, and I'll be doing something in June there, and also in September. And finally, we have a program which is a four-day. It's the flagship Bregman leadership program, where we really have an in-depth leadership experience focused on emotional courage and gaining the skills we need to break through the challenges we're facing. That's in October in Connecticut.
All right. Now, give us an idea. I mean, who are the ideal people that are going to benefit for the most? Is there an age group? Is there a position in life? Anything like that? Who do you think that this is going to be affecting the most and to have the greatest impact on?
You know, I started out with the thought, because this is generally my client base, that this will be for CEOs and their leadership teams. And what I found after the first one that I ran, where we had CEOs, we had leadership team, people that reports to CEOs, we had the secretary treasurer of a country, we had a lot of really big people. And we also had people who owned a small business or was more mid-level in an organization. And I found that it was, for a variety of reasons, really powerful to have that mix of people. And so my answer, and really powerful for the CEOs in the room to have people who are not at their level, and really powerful for people who are at a different level to have CEOs in their room. And so I really, at this point, I feel very open. If you are committed to engaging more deeply in your own leadership, in the sense of what I need to do to stand more grounded and centered in my own power in the world, in my own ability to make things happen in the world, in the context of an organization usually, and I consider a family organization, but for the most part, the way I speak about leadership, it's related to making things happen in the world from an organization perspective. That organization could be an organization of one, running a consulting firm, but it's, but you know, I think in terms of organizational leadership, for what I need to do to make things happen in the world, then I think these are really appropriate. Those are the people I want in the room.
All right. And what is the best way for people to get the information they need to sign up for this? Is it to go to the website, or is there also a number they can call?
Yeah, you know, the website is the best place. You go to www.peterbregman.com, and you can look through the website. There's a lot of free stuff on the website. There's, you know, whenever I'm on television or write an article, I always put it up there. And if you look at, there's a tab for leadership programs. And if you click on leadership programs, it has all the upcoming leadership programs.
That is great. Peter, thank you so much. And for anybody out there, if you were driving, if you didn't get a chance to write that down, you can always go to our site, answers4thefamily.com. You can go to our site. We will have Peter's information up on the site. Peter, once again, thank you so much for coming on. It is always a joy for me to have you on here.
It's my great pleasure. I love our conversation. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. For everybody out there, have a wonderful week. Be with us again next week and be good human beings. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.